You're listening to the Looseheads podcast. Join the movement.
Let's get people talking about mental health.
And together we will tackle the stigma. This is the Looseheads podcast.
So hello and welcome along to the latest episode of the Looseheads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union with me, Chris Hill. And as many of you will know by now, we combine the brilliant work which Looseheads do around raising awareness for mental health with some good old-fashioned rugby chat, and helping me along the way to do that is the Looseheads trio of Mark Shotton, Rob Shotton and Dave Nicol. And guys, it's been a while since our last podcast, but as you would have heard at the beginning of this particular episode, Rob has been working alongside local radio presenter Ian Downes, who works on a local station in Bristol. He's kindly given us some very professional intros and very professional voiceovers. So Rob, very, very good work on this. We sound like a very proper podcast now.
Yeah, it makes us sound like we know what we're doing, I think. It makes us sound a little bit professional. No, thank you to Downsley. He's a big supporter of Looseheads and, made us sound a little bit professional.
Yeah, and the work the Looseheads guys are doing throughout this pandemic, throughout the second lockdown period as well, it continues to grow. And do check them out on looseheads.co.uk across the social media channels. So they've launched some new recent merchandise as well over the last few weeks, and some of the videos they've been able to put together for sort of November and other courses has been brilliant, and the ambassadors have fully been behind everything which Looseheads do. So we're really, really grateful for their time and all the things which Looseheads have been doing at the moment. So as I said, it has been a while since we recorded our last podcast with England star Mo Hunt, and Series 2 has been kind of drip-fed slightly because of work commitments and stuff like that. And what isn't lacking is the quality of guests which Rob and the team have been able to get onto Zoom and do these podcasts. And we're absolutely delighted to say Harlequins legend, former England captain and soon to be one of San Diego Legion's star names, it's Chris Robshaw. So Chris, thank you so much for giving us your time to have a chat with us today. And first of all, where are you in terms of making that move over from the wintry months of the UK over to sunnier climes of California?
Yeah, firstly, if I can just apologise, I'm sure this is going earlier, for the choices I made in that Barbarians week. I'm sure we'll touch on it a little bit later. So apology to the Barbarians, the RFU, and of course the wider rugby community for letting the game down, letting the game we love down. I feel deeply shameful about the whole situation. But like you said, I'm sure we will touch on it a bit later from what we can. From where I am now, is still in Wandsworth, still in London, kind of waiting. I probably head over to San Diego mid-January, and then we'll have a quarantine period there, I imagine, for about 2 weeks, and then the pre-season starts beginning of February. Because of the COVID situation, the whole league's been pushed back a little bit. I was probably supposed to go around Christmas time, but now their season starts, I think, mid-March. I actually had my first Zoom call yesterday with my new teammates and the coaches, and Americans are just so nice. They're just so friendly. They're just so loving and genuine. And I'm really looking forward to it for me and my wife to live somewhere else, to experience a different culture, environment. And I think if you can't live in London, there's not many better places in Southern California. So I think it should be a bit of fun.
I'm sure obviously the weather played into this decision quite a bit, but I'm also sure that you probably had plenty of other offers on the table at the time. So kind of what was behind the decision to go to MLR?
Yeah, I wanted to go somewhere where, I mean, look, this season I probably played almost 30 games for Queens, whereas I'm 34 now. I've played a lot of rugby. I played my 300th game was my last game, which was quite fitting for the club. I played 66 for England. And I wanted to go somewhere where I could almost have a bit of that transition into the next phase. But I didn't really look at France or Japan because you're playing, again, 30 plus games in France, physical league. And with me, the American stuff is extremely exciting. There's a bit of the unknown about it as well. You're going to, and I've always liked America. I think a big factor was it's English speaking. I'm very dyslexic and I was as a kid as well. And I think to go somewhere properly and enjoy it, you need to be able to speak the language, because otherwise you'll be sat having a coffee, everyone will be speaking and you'll just kind of be minding your own business, so to speak. So that was a massive influence in it. The fact they only play kind of 14 games in a season as well was good. And hopefully I can get the best out of my body doing that. But also the lifestyle. Like I said, I've always wanted to live near the beach. I'm kind of born and raised in London. It's all I've ever known. And I thought, if I can't live in like this wonderful city, I wanted something completely different. And I think living near the beach, and the owner has a surf company, and he's told me he's made me a surfboard already.
Nice.
I told him it would look great on my wall, which he didn't find too funny. But no, it's again, more just completely different to what I know. I just needed that kind of mental freshness and a new challenge. So yeah, like, I can't wait to get over.
My wife and I spent our 25th wedding anniversary last year driving down Highway 1 from San Francisco all the way down. I want to go back. I'm coming with you, Rob. I'm going to be.
You know what? It's amazing how many people are like, won't come to Wandsworth to visit me, but will come 11-hour flight to visit me in San Diego. But yeah, look, I'm in the process of trying to learn how to ride a motorbike. I think that'd be pretty incredible on the coastal roads, and doing some road trips over there. So again, it's, my wife says it's a bit of a midlife crisis, but for me, it's more just doing stuff I probably always wanted to do, but because of the pressure here, because of the where you want to get to, what you want to achieve, it's a bit different. It's going there to, yes, work hard on the pitch and try and win a championship with San Diego, but also very much enjoy my time off it as well.
It's interesting you mentioned the surfing stuff, Chris, because when you did a big sort of press conference, I think it was with Harlequins discussing your move, you said, "I'm scared of sharks, so there's absolutely no chance I'm going to be going on the surf field."
Yeah, that is true. And to be fair, everyone from San Diego I speak to about it, and I say, look, I've done a lot of research, of course, on the place, and it's one of the highest for shark attacks. And I mean, one of the highest means probably one in about 5 million people or something. So it's obviously not that, but obviously you see that, you watch Jaws. Being an Englishman who doesn't live near the sea, it's scary. But they always say, look, we go in the sea every day, we've never seen a shark and all this kind of stuff. So I think once you get there, you just embrace it, don't you? And embrace that lifestyle. The Quinn's boys kind of tease me and say, when I come back, I'm going to have long hair and tattoos and all this kind of stuff and be a lot more relaxed, I think.
We'll look forward to seeing that.
Yeah, I'm not sure about it yet.
Just a shark teeth necklace around your neck, Chris, or one of those surf ones around the ankle. You mentioned sort of new challenges and a new start for you over in America, Chris. And, you know, it wouldn't be right for us not to talk about sort of what's gone on in terms of with Harlequins, because there is no doubt about it. You know, you're a club legend, one club man, spent so many years making Harlequins into the team and molding them into the team that they've become. And, you know, as you said there, 300 games to finish on was really special for you. So how do you reflect on your time now? Because obviously when the season finished, you could tell the emotion was quite raw, but we've had, you know, four or so weeks since the season finished now. So has it kind of sunk in about kind of you've even Harlequins behind and opening a new chapter?
It was emotional, especially the last couple of games. We were in a final and it was last home game and last game and 300th game and all this kind of stuff. And the club did an incredible presentation for me where they got kind of everyone in and socially distanced, and my family were allowed to come and revealed they were going to name a bar after me, which was absolutely incredible. It was just literally, the last month was very emotional for me and trying to hold back tears a lot of times. I think once the boys start playing again next week, I think then it will really kick in because of all the stuff with the bar bars and stuff. I've probably not been on social media as much as I have due to kind of stuff coming your way. So I haven't seen kind of them there kind of training and all that kind of stuff. And I actually think possibly for guys moving forward, that's quite a nice way of when you leave a club, and the guys, because it's always when they first go back to pre-season. Me and my wife had actually planned to go on a holiday when they were going to first go back, just so that it was kind of I've got my own thing to focus on. Because I think when you're sat at home, and I think now when you're locked down again, you can't really do anything bar a bit of exercise or go see someone for a walk or something like that. There's not a lot of options. So then you're like, you kind of want to still be there. But I think, yeah, when they first start playing, and I thought it would probably be a while, I'd probably give it a bit of time. And someone actually offered me the TalkSport. I do a bit of work with TalkSport. And they said, we're doing a Quinn's Exeter game, first game of the season. Do you want to come and do our comms with us? And I thought I'd have a bit more time away from the club than the last home game to the first home game again. But no, I'm not doing that. They're not doing it anymore. But yeah, I think once they start playing, then it'll probably hit me.
So will you be tuning in America at whatever time it is in the morning, probably like 4 a.m. will it be, 5 a.m. potentially?
No, I don't think it'd be that early. But yeah, I'm a Quins fan. It's a club. It's in my blood. It's a team I supported as a kid. I'll always, whether I'll be waking up early to watch them or always have kind of an eye on a score. And I think with social media now, you can tend to follow everything quite closely, or whatever you want to follow, you can follow pretty closely. So no, I'll definitely always have an eye on, and I'll always be cheering them on and seeing what they can do, and hopefully they can achieve, because that for me is when I look back. Yes, we did have some success, but you always want more. And that for me is when I look back and think, you always wanted more. Could you have done more? Could you have done this? And that they're the questions, I think, which eat away at you. And I don't know what the answer is to that. Mm. And I don't think you'll ever know the answer to that. Because at the time, you feel you're giving absolutely everything. You feel you're leaving no stone unturned. You're working hard. You're feeling like you're getting the best out of your body, the team. But that comes with age and comes with wisdom and comes with chatting to people. It's how many people always say, oh, if I could have gone back, I would have enjoyed it more. If I could have gone back and know what I know now, it'd be a different experience. But we don't have that knowledge, do we? And I think if I did it again, and I actually had a good chat with Stuart Lancaster not too long ago, just to kind of thank him and have a chat with him. And we'd shared the odd messages and stuff, but we hadn't stayed too much in touch. And that kind of happens with coaches and stuff. You have the odd message, but you'll go your own way and you've all got your own things. And I said, if I could do the England role again, or if I could do Quins again, I would probably have a firmer mentor. Like, I'd always like picking people's brains. I always like going and chat to influential people. Like, I remember sitting down with Tony Adams or Andrew Strauss or Kevin Sinfield and these type of guys, and just picking their brains. I think you can always take one or two things from them or reading their books. But I think it'd almost make one of those people a mentor and almost have a closer relationship to someone who's been through it. And because, yeah, I think then you could develop things and maybe bounce a couple more ideas off. But yeah, that's something I always enjoy doing, speaking to these people and trying to take their knowledge.
You feel that mentor role is something you might fulfill in the future?
Yeah, I think so. And it's something I do enjoy. I think I prefer that role to a coaching role.
Yeah.
I think with a coach, you have to be very good at breaking skills down. You have to be very analytical. You have to be very kind of time constrained. And it's almost a similar role that a Richard Hill, a Will Carling are kind of doing with the England setup at the moment, where they're kind of around, they're giving a bit of their advice, they're working with some of the older guys, the more experienced guys. Richard Hill in particular, some of the younger guys, when they first come into the camp, making sure they're comfortable, making sure they know what's going on. So yeah, I think that's definitely something I would like to explore moving forward. And it's when you actually think and pick your brain and think, what have I been through? And it's little things trigger it. Because you've been through so much in your career in your 16, 17 years, it is a massive roller coaster, especially playing international sport. And there are good times and bad times, and there are some times where you have to put your armour on and just kind of take it. And there's other times when you feel like king of the world. And it's taking it all with a pinch of salt. It's surrounding yourself with good people and coming through the other side.
My boyhood hero growing up was Jonathan Davis. And we did a podcast with Jonathan Davis, which I had to take a course of Valium to keep myself calm. But he said a very similar thing. He said, I don't see myself as being a first coach or head coach, but I would love to get involved in the mentoring of the younger players. And actually, without saying it, he's got, and you clearly have, Chris, an automatic response to things that happen on the pitch of which you're not in control of. But because you've done that for so long, you have an automatic response. And it's communicating that to a 17, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old young lad who could go the wrong way but could benefit from those wise words.
Yeah, definitely. And look, when I think back to my hardest times, and in terms of kind of the 2015 World Cup and the backlash of that, so to speak. And look, my wife was brilliant. My friends, my family were all fantastic. But it was, they were, a lot of them, and my friends in particular, would be kind of like, you're okay, things are fine. But they didn't really have any idea or any experience of what I was going through, being written on the back of every paper, being spoken about by blogs and podcasts and X, Y, and Z, giving you their opinions. And it was only when a lot of, like, Alistair Cook reached out to me, Sean Fitzpatrick reached out to me, Heineken Mayer, Stuart Connor, these type of people who have actually been through it.
Not a bad list of people to reach out to you.
No, exactly. And I remember Sean in particular, he messaged me kind of 2 days after the World Cup and obviously feeling terrible, turned everything off, deleted everything. And he emailed me and just said, look, nothing anyone can do or say at the moment is going to make you feel better. Yeah. But a sun will come up again. It might not be tomorrow. It might not be next week. It might not even be next month. But it will come up again and you will be okay. And I think with that, you do just need time sometimes. You need time to suffer, to mourn, to sulk, to do whatever. But things do turn. Things do move forward again. And look, I'm in a bit of a similar situation at the moment, of course, with the Barbar stuff and unfortunately that game being cancelled. And I can't go into it too much at the moment because it's still ongoing. But you've got to get your head down. And I saw something... Justin Langer spoke about, I watch a lot of these kind of leadership things and stuff. And he said, in times like this, in tough times, you need your mates. You need to talk because there's no point having mates if you're not going to share anything. And you just need to hang on in there because it will move forward. It might take a bit of time. Like I said, it might take a bit of time for the sun to come back, but it will come back at some point.
You touch on Stuart Lancaster there, Chris. I had the fortune to go and listen to him at he was doing a lecture at Manchester University as part of their sporting directorship, and he talked about his experience of the 2015 World Cup, and he talked about his experience of coaching players, and at the end of and you could have heard a pin drop in the room. He was engaging, he was enthralling, he was articulate, and at the end of it he was in his Leinster top and he was catching a plane and I from Manchester Airport. And I went up to him and said, Stuart, brilliant. Thank you very much. I'm just off now. And it became obvious he was waiting for a taxi that hadn't arrived. And I said to him, I'm literally passing the door. And he said, no, I couldn't do that. No, thank you. But look, Stuart, I'm leaving now. My car's there. I'm literally, if you want to give me £7.50, I'll claim I'm a taxi. But look, I'd love to... And well, if it's not too much trouble. And he got in the car, sat in the front seat. Rob was in the back. And we had a chat like you'd have in any rugby club in the world with Stuart Lancaster. And it was just, for me, it was brilliant. But for him, it was, you know, and I dropped him a text. And true to form, he came back and said, thank you very much. If you're ever in Manchester, I'll look you up. He may never. He probably won't. That's not the point. He was just a gentleman about it. And I look at that. I think he was a wonderful coach, it's a shame. It's a shame that maybe if you're Irish, his talents are being used at Leinster.
Yeah, Stuart's a great coach and he's a great man. And unfortunately for us, we blinked at the wrong time in that World Cup. We weren't a bad side, but our results obviously didn't go our way. And unfortunately, the fallout from it for him, myself, for the RFU, coaches, players, was huge. And it's stuff like that. You don't wish what we felt on your worst enemy, because it was the guilt you felt, the pain you felt was a horrible situation to go through. And that took me a long, long time. I remember kind of after that, there was a number of occasions which really kind of worked. And Eddie gave me a second chance to play, which I was extremely grateful. And we played the first game, we actually played back at Twickenham, was Wales in that Six Nations. I don't know if you remember. Mm-hmm. But we won the game. We almost actually lost it at the end. They kind of came back into the game, but we won the game. And I was doing a lap of honour. And just as I was doing it, I just broke down in tears. Just everything. And I had to go in. I didn't want people to see me like that. I just had to go in. And I remember a lot of the players at the time, just I literally couldn't stop crying. I was sat in my cubicle, and kind of guys were kind of coming around and consoling me, and they were like, look, we didn't realize kind of how much it affected you. And I think that's the thing with mental health and the stigma. I bottled so much up inside me, and look, it put massive strains on relationships, whether that be wife, family, friends, whatever, because I came out recluse and I kept it all in here, and it wasn't the right thing to do, but at the time it felt like it. And I think, it again, if it goes through, it's talking about it, it's sharing it, and but yeah, just all the emotions just kind of came flooding out.
I love that phrase you used there about, you know, the advice you got, that the sun will rise again, because it will. But it doesn't deny the enormity of the situation at the time.
G'day guys, it's Brad Shields here. I'm a Loose Heads ambassador. You're listening to a Loose Heads podcast. Mental health is just as important as physical health.
Just listening to you, Chris, there talk about the importance of talking to other people when you are suffering, you know, a bit of a dark period. And as you mentioned there, saw the fallout from the 2015 World Cup, which you've spoken about before. It was kind of a really difficult time for you. But have you now seen, possibly since then, over the last sort of 5-6 years ago, people talking more about mental health issues in rugby in particular? Because we are seeing the work Loosehead's do is fantastic, and it is raising the profile of that. But I guess in the game as well, a lot more players are talking about sort of the struggles, and that can only be a positive thing.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's the brilliant thing about the sport we love and about rugby, isn't it? That, yes, if you do something silly, if you do something stupid, you will be teased and you will be taken the mick out of until the nth degree. But if there is something serious and it is an issue, guys are there for you. And that's definitely what I've experienced in my time. And I think it has come more and more. Every year it's growing. But I think with that, and it's little things like just putting yourself out there. And this is another thing from my experience. Like I said with Sean, my wife, after the World Cup, arranged for me and my best friends to go to a house in the middle of the New Forest. And we ate and we drank until we couldn't remember. And it wasn't probably a sensible thing, but it allowed me just to forget about it for a couple of days. And then myself and Stuart actually went to Buckingham Palace to meet the Queen, and all the captains and all the coaches went. And you could just, it was after we were at the World Cup, and you could feel all the pity from the other players and coaches. And we scurried out quite early. And as I was leaving, Heineken Mayer just grabbed me by both shoulders and just looked me dead in the eye and just said, look, you're too strong to let this affect you. And I think and there were so many little things which added up to help me getting out. It's a scar I'll always wear. I'll never be fully out. But I think it showed me that these people didn't know me, but they could see I was hurting. They could see something needed to be done. And they reached out to me. And that's the thing I think I learned most from this situation is, don't rely, if you think someone's struggling, don't rely on someone else to do something for them. Don't rely and say, oh, his wife, his partner or whatever will look after him. Don't worry about another friend. Just ask, do you want to go for a coffee? Do you want to have a chat? And then it's down to them. Because then that person still has to be receptive and that person still has to be willing to open up as well. But at least then you put yourself out there to see if they're okay. And that's the biggest thing I think I learned. Don't rely on someone else. Take ownership. And that, for me, showed real leadership.
Yeah, and I guess when you talk about that, Chris, that there is a reason why you're part of Restart Rugby, and I know, I think you're an ambassador for them as well, and I know you've been able to pull on a Loosehead's T-shirt yourself, I think through Charlie Mulcrone when he was with Quinn. So was that something as well that you decided upon yourself to say, well, as you just said there, don't leave it for somebody else to do. I'm going to try and make a difference myself as well.
Yeah, I think so. Especially the way I probably dealt with it. I probably didn't deal with it the right way myself. In looking back at things, and because whenever I think with stuff like this, and whenever you see a situation going on, and then when you're in exactly the same situation, I think you give yourself a much harder time than you would the other person who's going through the same situation. And I think now to be able to share, to be able to be more open about it, and look, don't get me wrong, I'm not a massive open book, and I'm quite an introvert myself, and it's something I did have to work on massively. But again, it's making yourself accessible and saying, come on, let's go and do something. And look, you're probably not going to do it to everyone, but it's probably going to be the people who you are closest to with. And I think it's It's having the friendship groups around you. And that's when, in those tough times, you need to be dragged out of it. Like, I didn't want to leave the house for big periods of it. And my wife kind of made me laugh again. She made me kind of go out. She made me smile again. But it does take time sometimes.
Have your own experiences made you more aware of this and kind of more aware of how people around you are and their own mental well-being?
Definitely. Definitely in terms of a media perception and a media backlash. Because I think until you've been through something like that, you have no idea what it's like. And I think for most people that read, I don't know, some rugby player getting bagged or a footballer or a cricketer or something like that and have just think it's just like that. But the effect that that can have on you as an individual, your family, your loved ones, the wider circle, because even though whether you stay off social media or you stay off the news or whatever, you know it's going on. You can sense it that people are talking about it, your family are reading it about it, and they're hurting because of it. So it's when players go through that, it's trying to be there for them. I remember Carl Sinclair had a bit of a tough time and a bit of a backlash when England went to Wales a couple of years ago. I think he gave two penalties away, and for some reason, the whole game was pinned on him from a media point of view. And it's just sending him a message, just saying, look, mate, there's a similar thing, these things pass, and don't hold yourself down, and like, I'm here if you want to grab a coffee, and all that kind of stuff.
And I guess campaigns like November as well, Chris, go a long way to raising awareness for mental health issues. And obviously you guys are all sporting your Movembers at the moment. I definitely can't grow one, which is why I'm not doing one. But I know you're getting involved with it yourself.
I just look like I'm ill, Chris. Sorry, I'm trying.
The stress.
But are these things important, Chris? Because we can have a laugh about it now and they all look at Dave, look at Mark's moustache or whatever. But they are important. They do have a serious message behind them and they are getting more and more out there on TV ads and on social media, etc.
Yeah, you see them on kind of every bus at the moment as well and all that kind of stuff. And it's huge. It's about raising awareness. And I think with the players, with the rugby, with a very masculine, so to speak, environment or what traditionally people experience from it, it's about making sure you are open and making sure you are kind of explaining as best as possible. Because, and I always think with things, if we can put a bit of light in for it, who knows who might see it? Who knows who might think, oh, actually, maybe I should go get myself checked, or maybe it is fine for me to feel this way or be the person I am. Because look, there are so many people in the world who want to knock you. There are so many people who want to take a shot. If you do well, they want to take a shot. If you don't do well, they want to take a shot. And it's about supporting people, supporting good causes, and trying to help people move forward.
Yeah, and you touched on it so far in the podcast, Chris. And before we get into sort of the barbarian stuff, before we press record, we said to Chris that this podcast has never been about making headlines. It's not going to start doing it now because Chris is kindly giving up his time to speak to us. And we are going to just touch on the barbar stuff because you said at the start there you're disappointed with how it happened and you have been subjected to sort of the backlash from it as you've talked about on social media. But just how do you kind of reflect on that situation?
Yeah, look, due to it ongoing still, unfortunately, I can't really go into it. The hearing's still ongoing. But massive regret, massive sorry to let the game down, let the barbars down, let England down. And deeply sorry. And unfortunately, that is another scar I will always wear. It's something that will be some bad choice I made in there. The implications have been huge, unfortunately. So yeah, I'm sure in due time we can speak a bit more about it. But unfortunately, at the moment, we can't.
Yeah, no, I think you've said what you wanted to say on the situation as well, Chris. But from my point of view, and this is my personal opinion, which I wanted to get out there on this podcast, is that obviously Chris is disappointed, he's frustrated with what happened, that some of the abuse that he and other members of the Barbars team received on social media was completely unacceptable. And there's a line in everyone makes mistakes, and Chris has openly said he's made a mistake there, but some of the comments and stuff that he received, it's just not on. And this is the problem that people have at the moment, isn't it, guys? That, you know, they might make a mistake and they're completely hounded on social media, which doesn't help the situation.
Yeah. To echo Chris there, I was frankly disgusted seeing some of the comments that came up on social media. And obviously, Chris, I know it's not something for you to comment on, but I think kind of having seen the week before the post go up about Finn Russell and Stuart Hogg sharing a beer and all the comments around how brilliant and wonderful rugby is, and then to follow that up the week after and the abuse that sort of you and some of the other players were subjected to, I think is frankly disgusting. I think sort of we probably all need to take a bit of a look at ourselves on that front.
I think off the back of that as well, obviously, Chris, you went down to East Grinstead Rugby Club where Matt Ritana, the police officer who was tragically killed, he coached there. He was very highly thought of. And I know there was going to be a minute silence for him at the England Bar Bars match. But I think it shows the sort of bloke you are. You went down off your own back and apologised. Just how important is it to sort of support grassroots rugby, especially in this tough time where all of these clubs have been told that, you know, the 2021 season is off the cards. And it's usually an escape for people to go down to the club, get away from their pressures of everyday life. You get down to your club, you're in your routine of Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. What advice have you got for these players, and how important is grassroots rugby?
Grassroots is massive. For me, like I said, I was dyslexic as a kid. I was very stubborn. I was kind of confused with this. Rugby was my escape from a little age to even now. I love playing the game. I love going out there and having a bit of a kick around with the mates in the garden. I don't like going out when it's kind of 5 degrees, raining, snowing, the gales coming in. It's that mental side is a little bit different. But look, it's massively tough on all clubs around the country. Unfortunately, it's massively tough on everyone at the moment. My wife's a singer. She hasn't had a paid gig in, I don't know, 10 months or so. And the arts has been decimated. Sport as well. I think, again, just hang on in there. I mean, there was massive news coming the other day about a vaccine is hopefully on the way. And that has given a glimmer of hope, and that has given a glimmer of excitement, and just speaking to people, everyone's mood has changed. And I'm sure it's hugely tough for everyone in that club environment, but like I said, hanging in there, because we will get through it. It might take a bit of time, and there might be some tough times in between now and then, but hopefully we'll come out the other side and it'll be so worth it.
Hi guys, I'm Sam James. I'm a Looseheads ambassador, and you're listening to the Looseheads podcast. Make your mental health a priority.
And I think what people can take solace in at the moment, Chris, is elite rugby is still going on. And we have the autumn internationals to look forward to, and England once again in action. And a lot of these kids now will be growing up, and even though they can't go out and play rugby, they can still watch their heroes on television. And you were one of the very privileged people, Chris, to have led the country and been given that captaincy. And was that something you kind of dreamt of when you were playing grassroots rugby, of thinking, I want to potentially play for England or maybe even captain the side?
Yeah, I think the captaincy was always beyond my dreams, to be honest. It was like every kid running around, I would be in the garden in my Quins, in my England kit, or tops, running around diving, not really knowing what I was doing, pretending to be Johnny Wilkinson trying to kick or anything like this. And it was what I loved. And even now, when you go back to the clubs and back to grassroots rugby, it's amazing seeing the amount of people, both boys and girls now. When I was a young kid playing, I don't think there are many women's teams. You look at the amount of women turning up to mini rugby, to club rugby, and of course with a league in place now as well, just winning the Grand Slam for England. It's massively growing, and look, it's something I've been very fortunate enough to do. I've been lucky enough to captain my country 43 times and play for them 66. But I think you would give everything up you have now to go and do it again, to go and play that one more time. You always want another game. And that's the thing, to play at an 80,000 packed Twickenham. I mean, look, it's great that international rugby's back, but Twickenham's not Twickenham without the crowd. And all stadium is as fantastic as it is to have sport back. That's what makes Twickenham special. When you get off the bus and you just see thousands of white shirts singing Swing Low as you walk in, that they're the bits that kind of get the hairs on the back of your neck going, to walk out and hear the eruption of people, to sing the anthem and you see your family just there and 80,000 people around you singing with you. they're the special times, and that for me is Twickenham, and that's what I will miss.
Because you've spoken fondly of Stuart on the podcast so far, and Chris, and I mean, what was that sort of debut like for you when you were given the captaincy? Because if I'm right in saying you'd only maybe, is it one or two caps I think you had before sort of you were given the captaincy?
Yeah, just one before, yeah. So we'd kind of spoken, and it was away at Murrayfield, my first game as captain, leading the guys out, and you're in the tunnel and you're thinking, this is beyond dreams. This is what I've always wanted to do, because when you're in England, throughout the week, you're obviously training extremely hard. There's media appearances, there's physio, there's meetings. It's quite intense, as you could probably imagine, being an international setup. And then you get to the game and it's, for 100 minutes, you get to do the thing you always loved, the best 15, 23 in your country, be the best in their country, playing in brilliant, packed-out stadiums and challenging. And I remember meeting Princess Anne for the first time and just thinking, oh, God, because you have to introduce all your players. So it's trying to actually remember people's proper names and not nicknames. So I was so nervous and worried about. We had a guy called Carl Dixon at Harlequins, and at England, Lee Dixon was playing, his brother. So I was like, oh, God, make sure I say the right first name and all this kind of stuff. And I think I was actually probably more nervous about that. And once I actually went up and lifted the Calcutta Cup and got it up there, and the lid fell off and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, so they're the little things I think you remember. The games, of course, are amazing, but it's the little moments around it, I think, which are extremely special.
And I guess when you talked about the little moments there, Chris, as well, when you mentioned sort of that first game after the World Cup, when you said, you know, you had to take yourself away to the dressing room because of the emotion. I mean, on the back of that, England went on a sensational run, and you were very much part of that unbeaten run that Eddie Jones' side had. So did that kind of maybe not aid, but kind of help you maybe brush what happened in the World Cup in 2015 to one side, because you were now part of this new era for England that was seemed to be brushing everybody aside in the World Game?
Yeah, I think it did massively help. I think it will, like I said, a scar will always be a part of me. It will always be on my skin. It will always be there. In time and stuff, things do fade and things do get easier. And I think definitely winning the Six Nations kind of straight after, for me to go to Australia. The second game was my 50th cap. I was man of the match. And then in the change room, Jason Leonard presented me. We just won the series there. Jason Leonard presented me with my silver. You get a silver cap for your 50th. And all the boys cheered. And just, again, it was just so emotional. It was just, for me, to finish that year from what started so stressfully and being such a tough run to get there. And then we went to win that 3-0, that series, which no England side had ever done. Was special. And they are the moments.
Chris, can I just take you back or to that place where you face New Zealand? Everybody's rugby Everest, I guess, or am I wrong? And just what is it? The white hot heat of an international game, Murrayfield, Cardiff, Paris, all that. But what's it like facing New Zealand?
It's, again, the first time I faced them, man. And I think we're facing New Zealand. I think I've faced them maybe about five times and only won once. They just have this ability to be so clinical. But there was something special. I remember kind of leading the guys out for the first time and Ma Nonna was walking past the change room, and you've got Sam Whitelock and all these kind of big people you kind of looked up, grew up watching. Then to be on the pitch, for me, I kind of idolised Richie McCaw as a kid. He was one I wanted to go, and luckily enough, I managed to swap a couple of tops with him over the years and have some good battles with him. And to face a hacker for the first time at Twickenham and kind of swing low, kind of sung out around it, was almost a bit surreal, to be honest. Because I love watching the hacker. I know it means a lot to the New Zealand people about the heritage and the culture, but from an English point of view and from my point of view, it's a brilliant part of sport. I don't think it gives him an extra advantage. I don't think it takes anything away. I just think it's a brilliant part. So to face that and hear swing low, and also I faced that in New Zealand where you get people in the stadiums doing the haka and kind of round the pitch and you get thousands of people, and it's a very different feeling because you can almost hear them all chanting it. But yeah, to face them was brilliant. I kind of wish my record was better against them, to be honest.
One out of five is probably better than most.
unfortunately so. Yeah, but against like Australia, we always tend to be quite even. But yeah, New Zealand and South Africa, we never really got the rub of the green too much. And yeah, I don't know why.
And in your position in that back row, for crikey, forever, but for the last 20 years, New Zealand just seemed to have players who were born to play in that position.
Yeah, I think so. But I think you look at this England side now and you look at the amount of back row coming through and it's equally as exciting, if not better, I think. They could pick one of nine guys and you'd think, wow, what a good player, what a good selection. Yeah. And that, for me, is England's strongest position at the moment, I believe.
Do you think that role of the back row, it has evolved and it's changed a little in the last 10 years, your playing career in England? We seem to have gone back to a little seven and a big six instead of two six and a halves, sort of.
Yeah, well, I think that was Eddie's choice. I mean, that in itself, the two six and a halves was brilliant because that, I remember we played, obviously when Eddie came in, he had said what he did in his media columns and I wasn't too hopeful when he came in, I was going to play again because of what he had said. And then after that last game in France where we just won the Six Nations, Haskell being a bit of a joker he is, he just gave me this horrible little wink. And I was like, what is he going on about? And he'd got a kit man to make two six and a half shirts. So we got Eddie in the middle and we held up our six and a half shirts with a grand slam. And I said, what would you have done if we had lost? And he said, no one would have ever known. But again, it's having good characters like that around and who can do stuff like that and take the mick of themselves. And yeah, look, we did okay for two six and a half, I think.
Very, very well. But we've now got the bonkersness of the Curry twins, Underhill. And as you say, there could be, you can perm any, probably three, but maybe even two, from 9 or 10 fantastic players. I wanted to ask you, just how good close up and personal training day in, day out is Alex Dombrandt?
Yeah, I think Alex is brilliant. I think he's got the skills. I think his physique has changed massively in the last 2 years. He always says he did uni the proper way. He enjoyed himself and he was a natural player. And I think you see in his ability, his skills are phenomenal. And I think his defence never gets the credit it deserves. He hits people hard, he bangs people back. And I hope for him it's a matter of time before he does get an opportunity. And I think with all this stuff, you just have to be patient. I think he's got a huge bit of competition in Billy Vunipola. He's playing extremely well and a fantastic player. But I would like to think he would be the second off the ranks in that number eight position at the moment. And I think for players, and I always think, like, when Eddie's making his team, he's got a jigsaw. And at certain points, your puzzle bits fits for certain games. And unfortunately, his doesn't quite fit Eddie's picture at the moment. And that doesn't mean it's not going to fit forever. And he's still a young guy and he's got to be patient. And I hope for him, because I know how hard he works, that he gets an opportunity. And I'm sure if he gets the opportunity, he'll grab it with both hands and be there for a while.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, definitely, Chris. And, you know, you're a Premiership winner. You've won the Six Nations. I think you won Premiership Player of the Year as well. So moving on to sort of the Mars 15, this should be very, very interesting indeed.
Just before we go to that, Chris, you touched on, Chris, you've obviously achieved some things in your career, Premiership Player of the Year, Premiership winner, England captain, Six Nations winner, the list goes on. But how about having your name wrapped in one of Stormzy's songs?
Ellis Genge has never been so jealous of me. Yeah, it was that was a unique experience when someone messaged me saying that once. No, I'm a big fan of his music, but yeah, that was quite a surreal moment. And yeah, I remember, again, it was that Australia tour that it was kind of coming out, and yeah, it got played a fair amount, as you could probably imagine. It got me a lot of street cred amongst the younger boys, that's for sure.
Amazing, amazing.
Have you met him, Chris? Have you ever met Stormzy?
I haven't, no.
That's got to happen.
It's got to happen.
Maybe a collab one day. Maybe that's my next role.
San Diego Music Studio. So here's the premise. the Martians have landed. They've not realised we've got coronavirus. They've landed on Earth. They've challenged the Earth to a game of rugby to decide who has powers of attorney over Earth. We've done the toss. We've lost the toss. So on Saturday, our shuttle takes 4 weeks to get to Mars. Then there's a small matter of a reasonably big game. And then there's the shuttle back, but also a fairly big night out on Mars. So for a England captain, 300 appearances for Harlequins, somebody who's synonymous with the game of rugby union in England and this country, I'm really looking forward to how Chris Robshaw pieces his team together. So, Chris, your greatest team, any gender, any era.
Okay, do I need to explain or do I just say?
Yeah, no, say why. We've got to know why.
Okay, loose head, I'm going to go for Joe Marler. Just a hell of a character. I've known him since he had kind of dyed red hair and all sorts. But yeah, great player, great person to have in your change room. And if you're going to be away for a while, he'd be entertaining. Jamie George, again, fantastic player. But whenever I've been in the England camp, he's been social sec. So it's always his job to come up and entertain the guys, whether that's being making up stuff like, I'm an England rugby player, get me out of here, where he'll bring in snakes and spiders and all this kind of stuff. So I'll go for him. Number three, Dan Cole. He was my roommate every time we toured together or every time we were with England. So I don't know who else I'd share a room with. And actually after his wedding, because it was pre-World Cup in 2015, I think he got married and got to spend one night at home, and then for the next 3 months spent a room with me. So I'd spent more time with him than his wife. Number four, I'll go Martin Johnson. Just the legend that he is. I've got a couple of people that could be captain, but I'll probably make him captain. Good enforcer as well, especially in the Martians, are going to be quite big, I imagine. Number five, Maro Itoje, the best second row I played with. Phenomenal athlete, phenomenal player. And I think he's just going to get better and better. Number six, Schultberger. He's a player who I was lucky enough to play against a couple of times when he was at Saris and towards the end of his Saffir career. He's one I actually wish. I kind of wish and also kind of wish I didn't play against him in his prime, just to see how good he was and how fierce he was. And even as a kid, I remember a young 20, I should say. I grew my hair long to try and be like that. Number seven, Richie McCaw. Yeah. The best flanker there's been. The best flanker there's been, full stop. A guy who, again, I kind of wanted to be kind of growing up and wanted to play against. Number eight, Delalio. Phenomenal player for England. Phenomenal character from when I've met him and when I've been about him. I'm sure he'd be good fun on the tour as well. Number nine, I'm going to say Gareth Edwards. Going back a little bit, the greatest try of all time. And I'm sure he could spark this team into life. And I suppose you've got to have a Welshman in there somewhere. So I'm going to say 10, Farrell. Again, a phenomenal player from his early days. He's been brilliant. You take Owen Farrell out of a training session and I think the volume drops by 80%. He's so driven. He knows where he wants to take the team. He knows how he wants to get the best out of people. Number 11. The biggest game changer of them all, Jonah Lomu. Yeah. Would have loved to have seen him, played with him, met him, witnessed him, all of the above, really. A guy who I think he only actually played like 20 or 30 times for the All Blacks, like not as many as people would probably assume, but the impact he had on rugby was probably bigger than any name I can remember, really. I mean, Jonah Lomu rugby, everyone. I think people still play it. Number 12, I'm going to say Nonu. Our Nonu, phenomenal player. Always quite a scary guy to play against, physical, but his skill level was phenomenal. Probably the best 12 about. It was a tough one between him and Jamie Roberts. I know Jamie well. We used to car share, so we could have shared a little lift up there. Potentially. 13, O'Driscoll. from what he achieved in the game, from what he did, seems like a great guy to have around as well. But as a player, yeah, phenomenal. I'm going to say number 14, Brian Habana. He was electric. The amount of times he scored, the amount of intercepts he got, he was under a high ball, absolutely phenomenal. And whenever I've met him, he's always been a great guy, nice to get along with. I'm sure he'd be a good teammate. And number 15, I'm going to go for Jason Robinson. He's a player I always, similar to Scott Berger, that I always wished I kind of had a one-on-one against, just to see kind of, I know I would have got nowhere near him, but just to see how dangerous his feet were, just in 5 metres, just to, yeah, I mean, like I said, I kind of grew up watching that 03 era a lot and seeing how dangerous he was and the way he would light up. I went for my team manager, Jason Leonard, the fun bus. I think he could be, I think he might have a couple of nice entertaining games and bits and bobs for us to do on a long tour. I'm going to put my ref as Nigel Owens. He's always good for a couple of the one-liners, good referee, always has good games. I didn't do coach or kit man. I went water boy. I went for Ed Sheeran, I think. So when we have a little drink, he can sing to us and make us relax in between the time and obviously give us some entertainment on the way. And I went for the chef stroke nutritionist, the Gordon Ramsay. Of course, going to be on a shutter for a long time. We're going to need some good quality food. And yeah, that is my Mars 15 plus a couple of others.
Just going back to the scrum half, your fellow Millfield old boy, Gareth Edwards, who was from a different era. Does that suggest how good he was?
Yeah, I think so. And also I felt I had to go for someone, I don't want to say too old, but a little while ago. I mean, look, in all of these positions and in all of these things, you could have put, I mean, I've played with a fair few good scrum halves as well. Yeah. Danny, Ben Youngs, of course, just got his 100 against. You look at the Faf, you look at Aaron Smith, you look at, I mean, world-class nines, so there's a huge amount of them. But I thought I'd give myself a good balance.
Yeah, no, fair play.
Also, a lot of leaders in there, Chris, as well. Is that sort of your mindset as well? Just, you know, your Dallaglios, your Johnsons, etc. There's a lot of people who could easily put their hand up for the captain's arm on there.
Yeah, I think so. And I think with leadership in the captaincy, they always think it's a one-person thing, and it's not. You need to have a good group of leaders around you, because it can be a lonely place and it can be tough, and you need people to support your decisions and to support driving aside. And I remember when I was captain, kind of, you would have guys running attack, defence, scrums, lineouts, backfield, and you're kind of overviewing things. We go into a leadership meeting with Eddie and you've got 2/3 of the team there. Because again, you need to have that many leaders on the pitch. Of course, they need to know certain people are in charge of certain things. We all want the team to win. We all want to get the best out of each other. And if it's my idea or someone else's idea, as long as it's best for the side, that's what matters.
I would love to see Joe Marler and Gordon Ramsay just have a conversation, and that's it, just on Mars. That'd be fantastic. Both brilliant, colourful characters, aren't they? So it's a brilliant team, Chris. And unfortunately, we're running out of a bit of time, because I know you've got to head off very shortly. And we'd love to potentially do another podcast with you again further down the line, where you sat on the beaches of San Diego and enjoying the rugby out there as well, Chris. But it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you this afternoon, Chris. We really appreciate your time.
Absolute pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me along. And yeah, look, I'm sure once I'm over there, there's a lot of interest about what's going on over there. So yeah, more than happy to. I'll get a nice background as well, rather than my cupboards.
Maybe palm trees and beaches, Chris, surely.
Definitely. Get a surfboard there.
Brilliant, brilliant. And as always, many thanks to Rob, Dave and Mark for their time on the Loose Heads podcast.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you very much.
And that has been another Loose Heads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union.
You're listening to the Loose Heads podcast. Join the movement.
Let's get people talking about mental health.
And together we will tackle the stigma. This is the Loose Heads podcast.